Coming up, Jewish humor. As Bob Fall reports, it's an essential defense against suffering, especially when Jews mock themselves.
There's all these old Jews telling jokes.
Why don't Jewish mothers drink? They don't want to dull the pain.
Also, Fred DeSam Lazaro reports on the destruction caused by Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines and what survivors say saved them.
Every person that I've talked to and listened to their story tell me how their faith got them through.
And the Jewish holiday of Tu B'Shvat, the New Year of the Trees.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. The nation marked the 50th anniversary of Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty this week with vigorous debate about whether government efforts have succeeded at pulling Americans out of poverty. For months, the U.S. Catholic bishops and other religious leaders have called on Congress to protect those who are unemployed or on food stamps. This week, there was surprising bipartisan movement in the Senate to extend unemployment benefits for the 1.3 million long-term jobless. But the bill still faces more hurdles. This came as Congress neared a deal on a farm bill that will likely include $9 billion in cuts to food stamps over 10 years. And this week, a group of senators pushed for the U.S. to welcome more of the millions of Syrian refugees fleeing from that country's civil war. So far, 135,000 Syrians have applied for asylum in the United States, but the U.S. admitted only 31 refugees last year. Illinois Senator Dick Durbin said the U.S. has an obligation to address what he called the world's worst humanitarian and refugee crisis since the Rwandan genocide 20 years ago. A new report says the crisis in Syria may also have been a factor in the deaths of more than 1,200 Christians in that country last year. The non-denominational group Open Doors documented over 2,100 Christian deaths worldwide in 2013, which is double the previous year's total. The figures came from the group's World Watch list of countries that persecute Christians. North Korea topped the list for the 12th consecutive year. Somalia was second. Syria came in third.
The legal fate of over 1,000 newlywed same-sex couples in Utah is in limbo just weeks after a federal judge ruled they could marry. In December, the judge overturned the state's ban on gay marriage, which immediately led many same-sex couples to apply for marriage licenses. But the state appealed the judge's ruling, and this week the U.S. Supreme Court issued a stay. The federal government says it will recognize the 1,300 weddings that already took place, while the state of Utah says it will not.
In other news, a new report from the Centers for Disease Control says more unmarried women who get pregnant while dating are choosing to move in with the fathers rather than get married. The report calls this arrangement shotgun cohabitation, which is now significantly outpacing shotgun weddings. The survey shows that between 2006 and 2010, 18% of all single women who became pregnant moved in with their boyfriends before childbirth, compared to 5% who got married. The Vatican confirmed this week that Pope Francis will travel to the Middle East in late May. He plans to visit Jerusalem, Bethlehem, and Amman in Jordan. His objective is to improve relations between Roman Catholics and the Eastern Orthodox and with Islam, and, of course, encouraging Israel and its neighbors to make peace. Also, taking aim at priests paying too much attention to advancing their careers, Francis has ordered that no more priests under 65 will receive the title Monsignor. In Manila, in the Philippines, several hundred thousand people assembled for the annual Feast of the Black Nazarene, a life-sized wooden statue of Jesus believed to have healing powers. 90% of Manila's people are Roman Catholic, many of whom tried to touch the statue and towels that had touched it, hoping for answers to their prayers. Meanwhile, in the southern Philippines, the power of prayer has been a common theme among survivors of Typhoon Haiyan. Fred DeSam-Lazaro talked about prayer with those trying to rebuild and with some of the relief workers helping them.
The church has always loomed large in the life of the Philippines, even in the ruins of typhoon-swept cities like Palo, where almost every tree and every building lies damaged or flattened, the church stands tall. However, the church property did not escape the wrath of Hurricane Haiyan's record-breaking storm surges that killed at least 6,000 people. A fresh reminder of those deaths is inside the church compound.
People didn't know what to do with the bodies of loved ones, and so in the backyard of the cathedral in Palo lies a mass grave. No one's entirely sure of a body count beyond an estimate of several dozen.
Church services have continued in the cathedral, still bearing its extensive scars. Early morning on November 8th, just as Mass was ending here, the storm surges intensified. Some 300 congregants stayed on for what shelter they could cling to, even as the roof blew off and some walls began to collapse. They were guided to safer sections of the building by Palo's Archbishop John Doe.
So after my Mass, I was still wearing sotana, and the people gather, and they feel assured, and you know, they feel secured that there's a priest, there's a bishop with them. I said, "You go to this area, they follow me, and then they listen to me in that time when things are panicking." I said, "Just be calm, and you pray.
For many people here, he says, prayer has long been a central ritual in the daily routine. It was no exception in the Velasquez family that early November morning, trapped in this home as the storm hit.
We started praying the rosary, and then after we prayed the rosary, that was the start of my roof was already flying, the windows, the sliding doors. And then we went to one side of the house because we were afraid of the glasses.
The prayers continued as Velasquez and her daughter hung on just above the rising floodwaters.
"Lord, thy will be done. It's you. This is your will." So I started to ask for forgiveness. And suddenly our small Santo Niño came to me. This is the Santo Niño.
The statue that floated into her grasp, like this one, was, in her mind, a sign of divine intervention. Santo Niño, a Filipino representation of the infant Jesus, is widely revered here for its miraculous properties.
God was present with us. He was with us even if we were in the midst of the typhoon, of the storm surge. So I believe we were guided.
A few miles away on the morning of the storm, Marilyn Agno was also praying hard. She and several members of the extended family that shared this home clung to the trusses that supported the roof, hoping to ride out the storm surges.
With the third wave, the trusses gave in, and the current was too strong. I don't know what happened. I floated with the current, and I know how to swim.
Hours later, she awoke atop a heap of garbage, discovering soon after that that most of the family she was separated from did not survive.
My husband and my daughter, my son also, and my baby daughter, and my mother-in-law, sister-in-law, brother-in-law.
Only her younger 7-year-old son, Kyle, survived. He now lives temporarily with relatives away from the storm-damaged area as Agner tries to rebuild her life and livelihood. She owns a store that sells steel roofing materials and a small bake shop. I asked her, "Do you still pray?"
"Of course."
"Of course," she responded, in a mix of English and the local Visayan language. "I never stopped praying."
"I think this is a big trial to me.
This is a big trial for me. I must pray until the trial is over. I have trust in the Lord Jesus Christ."
Absent any kind of grief counseling, and that's not a priority with so many more basic needs still unmet, prayer is what has brought comfort, she says.
"To Jesus Christ, I told
Jesus Christ to help me move forward with my son. I'm praying that those who are no longer here are in heaven."
"Our people, yes, they grieve, but easily they can spiritualize their grieving. Well, God will take care of them, and they are in better position than ourselves here. They will say, he'll be in heaven, he will be in heaven. He will be praying for us."
Similarly, he says, people see God manifest in the neighbors and visitors who've come to their aid.
10 bars of soap, 1 10-liter jerry can.
One faith-based agency that's been central in emergency relief is the international group Catholic Relief Services. It's now moving from emergency relief to longer-term rebuilding, beginning with hygiene, water, and sanitation projects. Through it all, spokeswoman Elizabeth Troman says she's never once heard any second thoughts about faith.
"Every person that I've talked to and listened to their story tell me how their faith got them through. The comment that I have heard is that God can send the cyclone here because the Filipino people are so strong that we can overcome even a storm this strong."
Unshakable faith.
Unshakable faith.
And that faith will be the foundation of a rebuilding that will likely take years, given the limited resources available and also the ever-present threat in this flood-prone region of more natural calamities. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Fred DeSam Lazaro in Palo, Southern Philippines.
On our calendar this week, Christians around the world celebrated the Feast of the Epiphany, which recalls the revelation of God in human form as Jesus Christ. Orthodox Christians in Istanbul reenacted the baptism of Jesus by diving into the Bosphorus River to retrieve a wooden cross. In Rome, Pope Francis marked Epiphany by paying a special visit to a live nativity scene. Last year, he said priests should be, quote, shepherds living with the smell of sheep, and he seemed to take that to heart when a small lamb was placed on his shoulders, much to his apparent delight. And this week, many Eastern Orthodox Christians held special masses for Christmas, which on their calendar falls 13 days after Western Christians celebrate Christmas. The Jewish holiday of Tu B'Shvat begins Wednesday night. The holiday celebrates the new year for trees, spring in Israel, Israeli fruits and nuts, and more, protecting the environment all over the world. We spoke last year with Mattie Ettenheim, who was then an educator at the Eldridge Street Synagogue in New York City.
Tu B'Shvat is a holiday celebrating trees, essentially. It's the new year of the trees.
Why is Tu B'Shvat in winter? That's a great question. Let's answer that. Because in Israel, that's when the youngest plants are starting to come alive. The Tu B'Shvat Seder, it focuses on eating particular types of fruits and nuts at particular times. So there's 4 parts, and each part represents a different season. And all of the fruits that we eat are fruits that are grown in the soil in Israel. So the outside is soft and the inside is hard. What do we think that represents for spring? An apricot totally counts for that?
The Tu B'Shvat Seder is kind of similar to the Passover Seder. The word Seder means order. So just like the Passover Seder, you do certain things in a certain order, and all of that has symbols. Tu B'Shvat Seder has a whole spiritual aspect of it, where a lot of it is looking inward at yourself, and it's looking about being careful about judging others, and you relate that to fruit. So a tough exterior, but a very soft inside. One of the main connections between Tu B'Shvat and children is that it's fun. You know, there's a lot to do. Recycled instruments, and you plant a pot, and you look at worms in a compost bin, and you come eat fruits and nuts, and it's very interactive. A big part of the Tu B'Shvat festival and day is planting trees. There's millions of trees that are planted in Israel every year, and I know a big thing we do in America is you can send money or send seedlings to Israel and plant trees. You're eating all these fruits and all these nuts, and you're celebrating in a spectacular place. It kind of reminds you of all the great things and little pleasures in life that, like, may be hidden under a very tough, disastrous day in winter.
Finally, Jews and humor. A recent Pew poll reports that when it comes to defining Jewish identity, more than 4 in 10 Jews surveyed said having a good sense of humor is essential. Some say over the centuries, being able to laugh has become a vital defense against suffering, especially if the laugh is on Jews themselves. There's a show playing now in Chicago that celebrates Jewish humor. It's called Old Jews Telling Jokes, and Bob Faugh went to see it.
Three Jewish mothers are sitting on a bench, minding their own business. Think about it.
So, you want to know what is Jewish humor? You should be so lucky.
My wife likes to talk to me during sex. She calls me up and says, Nathan, I'm having sex.
As they say in the show, Old Jews Telling Jokes, now playing in Chicago, there are times when it's kosher for Jews to be hams.
There's all these old Jews telling jokes.
Why don't Jewish mothers drink? They don't want to dull the pain.
Audiences guffaw or wince at humor, which is all about coping and which thrives in a Jewish culture where everyone and everything can be mocked.
If I walk into a restaurant and there's a sign, food like mother used to make, I report them to the Board of Health.
If I wasn't a Jew, I would be a Catholic. If they do whatever they want, then they confess they didn't do it.
My Gentile friends, I've been to far too many wakes. I feel so sorry. 5 days, 8 shows a day, like vaudeville.
It's a culture, and one of the huge, huge parts of that culture is being funny, is comedy, is making fun, is, again, not that other cultures don't have that, but it's big time in this culture.
Jewish humor goes back to the Bible, says Harvard Yiddish scholar Ruth Wise. Remember Sarah finding out she was pregnant at around age 90?
And her response is to laugh.
Wise, who wrote a book about the history of Jewish humor, says that Jews, the so-called chosen people, subjected to centuries of persecution, have been laughing for centuries at their oppressors, at the incomprehensible, at themselves.
I tell you, my wife, she never went for me. Well, the first time I called her up, she told me, come on over, there's nobody home. I went over, there was nobody home.
In the past, whenever I had any sort of crisis at all, I used to consult with my analyst. This is public knowledge. I was in analysis for years because I've emotional problems that I had. I suffered from the delusion that I was short and thin.
When life is bad and kicks you in the kishkas, show the world that you're not gonna take it lying down. Tell a little joke.
Smile. From Roman times to the Holocaust, when hounded or despised, humor for Jews became a defense mechanism. Renee Matthews from Old Jews Telling Jokes.
It's our armor. You know, I'm going to laugh at this before you have a chance to poke fun at me. That's been the Jew's savior, I think, through generations. We can laugh at ourselves. Yeah. So if you can't do that, then you're a goner.
Doctor, I can't pee.
You can't pee?
I can't pee.
How old are you, Mr. Shapiro?
I'm 91.
You've peed enough.
Tim Kazurinsky, who acted with Second City and Saturday Night Live, now co-stars in Old Jews Telling Jokes.
As somebody once said, tragedy plus time equals comedy. And given that equation, it fits right in terms of tragedy. The Jews have kind of got a headlock on that. So.
And that gulf between being God's anointed and all that misery, says Ruth Wise, that incongruity is at the core of Jewish humor.
Some people call it laughter through tears. Some, I would suggest, you could call it laughter through fears. Humor, being able to laugh at this, is a way of being able to maintain this delicate balance without going mad. You know, humor is the one form that gives you the last word.
Over the centuries, she says, Jewish humor has evolved depending on what was happening to Jews. Their humor infused in no small part by the Yiddish theater 100 years ago and what comedian and writer Robert Klein calls those rhythms of funny in Yiddish itself.
Get a laugh on an old routine of mine by going, chabda, 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 you know, without even using any words, just sort of imitating it.
Of course, the flowering of Jewish humor was in the 1940s at scores of Jewish hotels in New York's Catskill Mountains, the so-called Borscht Belt, the training ground for so many Jewish comics, Sid Caesar, Jackie Mason, Henny Youngman, Myron Cohen.
This adorable little 8-year-old girl, quite like one you might have in your very own heart, walked into a bakery shop and said to the baker, "My mommy found a fly in the raisin bread." He says, "So bring back the fly, I'll give you a raisin."
The Borscht Belt became known as the kosher fertile crescent.
They were hired as waiters in their uncle's hotel, and they were told, be funny, because you have to keep the customer's mind off the bad food and off the bad conditions, and they cannot be allowed to ask why the pool isn't functioning today or something. Keep them laughing. So comedy became, professionalized that way.
There's a joke. A waiter goes to a table of Jewish people and says, "Is anything all right?"
Robert Klein, now 71, was there in those balmy, wacky days, starting at age 17 as a lifeguard in the Borscht Belt.
The comedian was the star. The guy would come in a Cadillac, and for 35 minutes, people's stomachs would hurt and their eyes tear, and they'd forget their disappointment in their marriage or their children or their health. And he'd go off to another bungalow colony or small hotel and do the same thing.
The Borscht Belt, where Jewish comics mastered both their razor-sharp barbs and exquisite timing to tap into time and time again.
For 49 years, she never got off my father's back. Buddy. You know, when my father got married, he was 6'1". He's 5'2½ now.
There was also in their humor something both self-deprecating then.
I had a Jewish delivery, which is they knock you out with the first pain. They wake you up when the hairdresser shows.
And now.
A beggar came up to my mother on the street and said, "I haven't eaten in 3 days." And my mother said, "Force yourself."
I wonder whether, in a sense, the self-mockery isn't saying, "Look at me, I can get to me much better than you can ever get to me."
A Jew dies. I mean, Jews bury very quickly, and that's all I can. I mean, Jews bury so quickly that sometimes older Jewish people around their relatives are afraid to take a nap.
I can make fun of myself at such a level advanced that beyond anything you can say about me that, you know, I'm immune to any criticism of yours.
As this off-Broadway show proves, Jewish humor, set in the everyday, championing the little guy, skewering the pompous, still thrives.
Of course, the last time I came home, I found my business partner in bed with my wife. I said, "Jake, I have to, but you..."
Funny is funny. I think it translates through generations.
It touches our lives. It deals with difficult situations, and humor is great for difficult situations.
Really great humor makes you uncomfortable because it reveals a truth which you could not otherwise reveal except in this humorous form.
Boy, that's the story of my life. No respect. Utter no respect.
So the punchlines may be ancient, but the laughter keeps on coming. What? Better you should cry?
It's hard.
hard to stop funny from spreading like wildfire. So who knows? Maybe the world will turn out all right after all. Couldn't hide.
For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Bob Fall in Chicago.
There's always old Jews telling jokes.
That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. And visit our website, where there's always much more and where you can listen to or watch each of our programs. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, Orthodox Christians in Jordan celebrating Epiphany.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.